Okay, I've gotten clearance that it is time to begin this debate. This is the second time our two guests have engaged in this debate. Today they were here in Regina addressing the National Association of Vice Presidents Academic from across Canada. And it was a very, very interesting opportunity for all of them, and as it will be for all of us. We're very fortunate to have Ian Clark and our own Ken Coates here today talking about essentially the future of the post-secondary system, or the lack of a post-secondary system, and its lack of a future. But let me just begin by introducing both of our guests, because they're really two remarkable scholars. And as I said this morning, they fit into a category that is very unique, and that is the scholar-practitioner. Both of them have been engaged in administration, public management, public policy development, as well as functioning at highest levels of scholarship. Ian has recently published two books on post-secondary education reform and is a leading scholar. But he also has a career. I don't know, I haven't actually ever talked to him about his early academic career as a physical chemist, but he has a PhD in chemistry from Oxford University in England. He also has a master's in public administration from Harvard's Kennedy School. And he's also a graduate of the University of British Columbia. He has been at the height of the public service in Canada, was the former Secretary of the Treasury Board, former Deputy Minister of Consumer and Corporate Affairs, amongst other portfolios, and the President of the Council of Ontario Universities, as well as an Executive Director at the International Monetary Fund. So he has he is a classic exemplar of that scholar-practitioner role. On the other part of the debate, which will be explained to you shortly, is Ken Coates, our Canada Research Chair in Regional Innovation. This is Ken is not new to the University of Saskatchewan. He's a former dean and a former acting vice president and provost of the University of Saskatchewan. Most recently, he was dean of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Waterloo, Canada's high-tech hub, and he is an expert on all things to do with innovation. So today we're going to be having a debate on the future of Canada's post-secondary system, what the future holds for the universities, and this isn't a debate in the sense that many people would be familiar with, and I'm referring here, of course, to the CBC's program, The Debaters. There'll be a much less emphasis on voting points and humorous repartee, although that will be part of it as well, I can assure you. I think the plan is to have Ian begin with a few comments, or Ken begin with a few comments, sorry, and then followed by Ian, and then a further elaboration of their each individual position. It's an important and profound debate that are facing Canadian universities, and in fact I learned more this morning about the nature of the debate than attending endless Dean's Council meetings and the other kinds of academic forums. So you're in for a treat. Hang on. Ken, take it away.
Well, thanks very much, Ken, and hello to both campuses of the University of Regina and colleagues at the University of Saskatchewan. The way we're going to do this is I'm going to give a fairly brief introduction as to why I think change is needed. Ian is going to pick up from there and give a few thoughts about that as well, and then go on to talk about the kinds of things that he think should be done. And then I'm going to come back up and tell him why he's wrong. So we've decided that that's how it's going to go, and then he gets the last word. So he can tell you all why I'm wrong. And I think that's designed to get sort of some discussion going. One of the things you'll discover in our processes, in our conversations, is that both of us love universities a lot. We know all the good things about universities, the wonderful impact they have on students, how they can change careers, change lives, the research that actually has profound implications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So get that out of the way first. We both love universities. We have a little bit different view as to what the challenges are right now. And mine's probably a bit stronger than Ian's might be. But my simple point is that I think universities are in need of a fairly substantial change, and that it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be profoundly difficult for some universities and for the system as a whole. My starting point would be simply that universities have had a very, very long run of good luck. Well-deserved good luck in many instances. I was the founding vice president and academic of the University of Northern British Columbia. It opened in 1994. At that time, it was the first new university that had opened in 25 years. And a lot of universities opened in the 1960s, early 70s, and this long sort of gap in between. Now we've opened a lot. New universities popping up, new campuses of existing universities, brand new institutions, university colleges and art schools that are transformed into universities. We've done an awful lot of universities created across the country. We've had a massive increase in the number of students going on to post-secondary education generally, but particularly to the university system. Our research funding has grown dramatically. Never enough. Faculty can always ask for more. We've had wonderful new facilities built on campuses all across the country. The number of graduate students has doubled across Canada in the last, I think it's 7 years or something like that. Huge, huge increases there. And to make sure we become as completely self-interested as a faculty member can possibly be, we now have the highest, on average, university faculty salaries in the world. In fact, technically, we're behind Saudi Arabia, but I think Saudi Arabia doesn't really count as a competitor to the kind of environment we have here. So we've done really well. The university system has done well. The interest of our students and the parents who often pay for big parts of their education remains very strong. And here's where my need for change starts to sort of hit in. A lot of that interest is founded on a very simple promise that universities continue to share. And it's the $1 million promise. You probably heard this. If you go to university and have a university degree, you will, on average, earn $1 million more than a college graduate. And now the evidence is you'll earn $1.3 million more than somebody who has a high school graduate. If somebody handed that in to you as an undergraduate paper in economics or sociology, you would give them an F for making that argument. And you'd be highly suspect, because an average is an average. That means that some people probably make an awful lot more than $1 million more than a high school or college graduate, but it also means that some actually make less. And when the answer basically is, we actually found a couple of university websites that say, come to university, you'll earn basically $1 million more without qualifications, is very misleading. And one of the things that we haven't done is actually challenge and question that particular number. So I think the university system is at risk for some reasons that I'll explain. Number one, healthcare is eating government from the inside. The costs of meeting our healthcare challenges are going up very dramatically. Education spending, post-secondary education spending is going to be basically squeezed out very significantly. And government deficits in many parts of the country. We actually talked today to Vice President Academics and VP Admins from across Canada, will be very much constrained by government borrowing ability and deficits generally. We have also the problem, the national problem of the declining roles of universities in public affairs. The Council of Ontario Universities did a survey before, not the last election in Ontario, but the one before, where they wanted to find out where universities sat sort of in terms of the overall public interest in universities. And I think it was either 8th or 9th or something on the list. It was quite a ways down. And when that was, you drilled down and said, well, what part are you interested in? Essentially, the overwhelming answer was accessibility. Which is a really nice way of saying, I want my son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter to go to university. That's the issue. Accessibility is the issue. On the other side of the quality of institutions and the funding for research and faculty salaries and working load, not so much of an issue as well. It works the other way around. We have provinces in Ontario where we actually have a sharply declining population in terms of high school graduates. They're talking about adding new universities to expand accessibility. In Alberta, where we have a huge number of students looking for university opportunities, they won't open up any more spaces. Interesting. Universities have business models that don't make a lot of sense. They're not very sustainable. Faculty salaries are, in fact, very high. And so what do we get? Higher tuition fees and a far greater reliance on contract lecturers. The expansion of sessional teaching is changing the very function and operation of universities in dramatic ways without sufficient attention to how that is actually affecting the whole university environment. Finally, we in this particular area, we've also oversold the universities. University presidents, vice presidents, deans have been remarkable proponents for the university model, what I call the innovation equation. The innovation equation is very, very simple. It says send a lot of students to university, fund a lot of basic research, set up a commercialization office or a tech transfer office, and you will have jobs, prosperity, and happiness across the entire land. It's a very simple model that has actually been replicated all around the world. Very simple innovation equation. And the university system has promoted this very aggressively. Never really asked if it's working or not. And in fact, it does work a certain amount, but we've oversold it. We've oversold individual scientific projects, oversold the whole idea of graduate education, oversold the idea of universities as sort of the seedbed of entrepreneurship. Those are testable propositions, and we've chosen not to test them. So there's growing public concern, at least in my mind. The employment experience of many university graduates. I don't know if you watched the debate the other night between Obama and Romney. Universities did not figure very prominently, except when they talked about student debt and how you pay off student debt. And Romney said this one thing. He said, you realize right now that 50% of university graduates in the United States are unemployed. Now, they fact-checked a whole bunch of things. They chose not to fact-check that one. It's actually not true. But what the number is probably closer to is 50% of university graduates are either unemployed or underemployed. In Canada, 39% of university graduates are doing unskilled work. That's a staggering number. And if you just go down almost anywhere, go to a hotel, go to a Starbucks shop or whatever else, you'll find an awful lot of university graduates who, when they started off university, were not thinking they were going to end up doing an unskilled, low-paid job. But 39% in Canada, it's one of the highest in the OECD. Universities are not focusing enough on student outcomes at all. University financial challenges don't interest government very much. And in fact, one of the things that really bothers governments about universities is how when they give more money, they just pass it on to the faculty. And we pass it on in one of two ways, either by giving faculty members higher salaries or benefit increases or reduced workloads. And so university governments are very frustrated with this because they get more money and then hear the same complaints about overcrowded classrooms and reliance on contract lecturers and what have you. Thirdly, there's this wonderful phrase that I think is one of the real catastrophes in the modern university, and we don't challenge it often enough. It's the phrase, it's only academic. Probably hear this 1,000 times a year. So what does that mean? Well, that means it's not relevant. It's not important, not timely, not significant, not pertinent, not useful. Not true also. Because an awful lot of faculty research has applications in terms of understanding the human condition, the natural world, but we let it go untested. In fact, we don't offer the counterbalance, which is to say, here's the way in which scholarly research is changing the world today, tomorrow, and 100 years from now, which is what the university system really should all be about. Finally, we would almost all agree that faculty-student ratios are going in the wrong direction. Classes are getting larger. They're being taught more by contract lecturers, short-term people. Some of whom are brilliant teachers, by the way, but they're living in... I know people in the Waterloo region who are actually teaching at 5 different universities a year, driving around one course here and one course here, down to McMaster, back over to York, back up and down. What a lovely life for somebody with a PhD and 9 years of teaching experience. But when it comes down to it, and one thing that we don't talk enough about, is the fact that the student experience is suffering, that going to university is not what... It used to be when I was young, which is now 140 years ago. But going to university is a very different thing than what we sell. Not very much access to professors. A provost at the University of Waterloo, a couple of times a year, would phone around departments on Friday afternoon to see who was in the office. And he'd just make a note of who was there. And then he'd phone the dean and say, okay, I just phoned around. Half the time the deans weren't there, but we were out working on other things. And basically, the student experience is not what we think we're selling. And I think we have to address these issues. We desperately need change. Over to Ian.
So thank you very much, Ken. And before I start, just let me say what a thrill it is for me to be back here in the Johnson Shoyama graduate school. Al Johnson was my first deputy minister, so when I went from the Harvard Masters of Public Policy to Ottawa, Al Johnson was the Secretary of the Treasury Board. That's where I began my career. And when I was a young, ambitious analyst and got a project where I had to make a presentation to all the deputy ministers in Ottawa. The presentation that I made, this is with Al Johnson, but it was at the Tommy Shoyama chaired Deputy Ministers 10 Committee, as it was called in those days. And so these are giants in my mind, and it's a thrill to be back. At the other point, I will just say, I mentioned this in front of the academic vice presidents, is one of my roles is as the chair of the accreditation board of the CAPA, which is the Canadian Association of Programs Public Administration, and we have just been through the accreditation of the Johnson-Shoyama programs, which came out with dramatically flying colors, and I use the Johnson-Shoyama website, its whole approach, its integration, as a model in talking with other schools across the country, both existing schools and ones which are thinking of coming together. So this is, it's wonderful to be here. I've got a storyboard on there which I will speak to, and most of these, all of these charts support the points that Ken was making, and I will elaborate on a couple of them. You might wonder, well, where's the debate? And the debate will come when I make the case that governments are going to be needed as partners and even as drivers of the needed reform, and Ken will rebut by saying that universities are capable of doing it themselves and governments may make it worse. So that's where the debate part comes in. But in terms of where we are and why reform is necessary, the first point, the first bullet, is there have been a number of compelling critiques of the university model. This applies throughout North America, indeed, most of OECD countries. I'll just start with the first one that many, like the former presidents we have in the room, will recognize is the Boyer Commission analysis of how undergraduate education was being shortchanged in American research universities and what research universities can and should do about it. Soon after that, the Alan Tupper, who's an old colleague of Ken Rasmussen and myself in the public administration field, and his colleague, Professor Pocklington, published this No Place to Learn book, which again was a critique of how universities are putting too much emphasis on narrow areas of research and not enough emphasis on the teaching. My former president of Harvard, Derek Bloch, followed with our underachieving colleges. Again, same kind of themes in those. And then the next one on that list is the book that I, with three other colleagues, published on Ontario called Academic Transformation, looking at the forces that were reshaping higher education. And one of the, we thought that was all we had to say. But as we spoke with university leaders across the country, and particularly in Ontario, about the conclusions they draw from these forces that were reshaping, the university administrators would tell us, usually off the record, that we had underestimated the difficulties and that they felt that they were stuck, trapped in a situation where, as administrators themselves, they could not undertake the needed reform. So we then, with the help of stimulation of Ken Coates's book and analyses like that, said, okay, if government has a role to play, what should it do? You know, what specifically could a government do? And we took Ontario as the case study to help universities undertake what we thought were the needed reforms. But looking quickly at the charts, so on the second one just notes the point of the million-dollar promise that Ken referred to, and that is personal incomes, on average, increase with the years of education. But as Ken noted, there's dotted lines above and below the average, and in some fields of study and some experiences they don't, and some they do very well. But that general line being up means that from an individual's perspective, there will always be an interest for lots of Canadians to go to universities, which puts a particular obligation on universities, which are the gatekeepers, the credential providers. They have an oligopolistic position. You can't go anywhere to get a university degree. You have to go to a university. They have an obligation, therefore, to provide that degree in the highest quality, most cost-effective way possible. Charts 3 and 4 just note that there's been an issue in the engagement in the undergraduate learning process, both on students' part and on faculty's part. So those charts just show over time the number of hours per week that students spend studying, committed to their academic work, has been steadily declining. It was about, this is American data, but it applies to selective universities and less selective universities, the whole gamut, that when I was going to university, we used to study on average 40 hours a week. Now, it's closer to 27 hours a week. It's kind of a 1% decline every year. And on the faculty's part, in the old days, most faculty members would teach what we call now a 3+3 load, three courses in one semester, three courses the next semester, and now the average is about 2+2 or less. Well, that's a 2/3 reduction over that period. So that leads to less engagement between faculty and students. The next bullet is tantalizing technology, and this has been, it's tantalizing because as the cost curve chart 5 notes, that the average cost of providing a course, at least putting it online, diminishes precisely proportional to the number of people that view the course. So it looks like there's some magic there. You can get the cost of delivery of higher education down to a vanishingly small number. Of course, it's not as easy as simply putting something up online. But the notion of technology changing the way higher education can and should be delivered has been talked about for a couple of decades now. In 1997, Peter Drucker, so that was 15 years ago, Peter Drucker, the famous management guru, said, in 30 years, campuses will be relics. We will be receiving our higher education in totally different ways. So we're halfway through those 30 years. This campus is not a relic. The University of Saskatchewan campus is a very beautiful non-relic, so it hasn't happened that quickly, but as the professors of disruptive technology theorize that these changes don't happen in a steady way. They kind of build to a point, and then they start happening quite quickly. And so there are some people who are saying that Drucker may not be completely right with the 30 years, but there may be a lot more dramatic change in the next 50. So that is something that all university leaders have to be thinking about. The big issue and the most, which has almost a moral dimension to it, in my view, is the unaffordable inflation element, where faculty, the costs of running universities, which is primarily in faculty compensation, have been increasing substantially faster than the incomes of Canadians. So that's the median incomes of Canadians, and applies to Americans as well, has been essentially constant for the last 20 years, whereas faculty compensation has been increasing at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% every year. And what that means, of course, is that for any fixed amount of tuition plus a fixed amount of government contribution, you get fewer and fewer faculty per student. And as Ken pointed out on the seventh chart, just notes that all the projections are that, from a government's perspective, the cost of health is going to continue to increase, so it will be crowding out the expenditures on all other programs, presumably including on higher education. So this crunch is coming, and it will affect universities in probably all provinces, but certainly my province of Ontario. My argument in the second set of bullets is that government impetus will be needed, because universities are trapped. They're collectively trapped in a number of ways. The first thing is all of them are competing over status. And what kind of status? Well, the nature of universities has evolved so that status is typically associated with the research mission of universities. So there's been pressure on faculty, going to box 9, lovely phrase, scholarship at gunpoint. So scholars are expected to perform because to help them get more status, to help this institution get more status, and so, which leads, in Philip Altbach's term, to institutional isomorphism. That is, all the institutions begin to look the same, and they aspire to look the same. And the disengagement issue that we discussed earlier, and George Kuh puts a nice term on this, he says that it looks like students and professors have developed a disengagement pact where the professors say, I won't assign too much difficult reading and writing to you if you don't bug me very much about why you're not getting good marks come around too often for your advisement hours. Obviously, these are all generalizations. There are wonderfully engaged faculty in all of our institutions, but the averages, those trend lines, are worrying. That's the competition over status. The second bullet there is this, what I've called the teaching research orthodoxy. It is a matter of faith bordering on religious belief by virtually all faculty members that you can't be a good teacher unless you are an active researcher. There's been a lot of research on this subject, and the answer is consistent and unequivocal. There is no relationship. There is no correlation. There are very good teachers and very good researchers. You don't have to be a very good researcher to be a very good teacher. You have to be scholarly. You have to have a scholarly frame of mind. You have to be committed to scholarship. But you don't have to be at the world's leading edge of chemistry, physics, English literature, in order to be a compelling, engaging, and highly successful teacher. So if that's the case, then these decline in hours of teaching per week that we see in four are easily reversible without reducing teaching quality, one would think. That is, you can get faculty to spend less time on research and more time on teaching, you'll get better teaching quality from the institution as a result. But given the competition of our status, there's a huge reluctance among institutions to differentiate themselves both within their institutions to have teaching stream professors and research stream professors, or to differentiate among institutions, have more research-oriented institutions, more teaching-oriented institutions. And as I say, the reluctance is based on a lot of things, but it has almost a religious ferocity about it. I developed the chart in chart 11, which I'll just explain briefly. You don't have to see it in detail, but it's based on the observation, which is kind of commonsensical when you think about it, that not all faculty are equally productive researchers. And you can do tests yourself on this if you want, by taking any professor that you know, or any list of professors in any faculty you know, and then go on to Google Scholar and look at how many citations there are to their works, which is a proxy for how much effect their research is having on the world at large. And what you'll find in the little experiment that I did in a field that I know, that I'm able to judge roughly the publication value, is in political science. So I looked at the so-called H index of political scientists at the associate professor rank in three different universities. You can probably imagine which ones they were, but they were in Ontario, and they ranged from the H index, which is the number of papers you have with a number of citations equal to that amount. They range from zero, so this is 19 associate professors. They range from zero, so this professor had no published work which had been cited by anyone else, up to 19, which means they had 19 publications which had been cited by at least 19 people each. It's a crude indicator, but it's easy, and it sort of comes up. You can calculate it easily by doing this on Google Scholar. There's many more sophisticated techniques you can use using more sophisticated bibliometric measures than Google Scholar. You could look at, you could also add elements such as research grants from the granting councils and so on. But the point is, if you look at any group of faculty members, they aren't equally research productive. So if you put them if you plot their research productivity by deciles, you get the kind of plot you see in the blue line in the lower left, which is what analysts call a power law function, where in this case, and it looks like it may be fairly general, 70% of the output is produced by the top 30% of the researchers. So if under scenario A, everybody is teaching and researching the same amount, then you get a total output of research and a total output of teaching of a certain amount. So now, in scenario B, you say, you do what you do in any business or any other part of life, you'd specialize. Those that are good at this, you'd say, do more of that. Those that are good at that, you'd say, do more of that. So in scenario B, for the top 30% of researchers, you say, we'll give you course relief for one course. Instead of teaching two and two and two, sorry, two and two, you teach one and two and spend that additional time doing research. For the rest, you say instead of doing teaching two courses and two courses, teach two courses and three courses. What do you get in this simple model? You get 20% more research output and 20% more teaching. Miracle. It's just the economies of specialization that were discovered the first time people started planting crops and doing anything in groups. So we really should differentiate in order to give taxpayers and students better value for money. The next point is the distorted labor markets. And Ken noted that Canadian faculty salaries are the highest in the world. The market out there, I happen to be sitting on a selection panel to hire new professors in one of the faculties at the University of Toronto. The amount of brilliant scholars who are on the market who would absolutely love to come and work and teach under any conditions. You could ask them to teach, you could ask them to teach four courses a term. They would love to come to our universities. It's amazing. So these are the statistics in box 13 in Ontario. There are five PhD holders in Ontario for every person who's on a faculty. We get in Ontario 4.4 new PhDs from both what we graduate and who immigrate to Ontario. 4.4 new PhDs for every professor who is retiring. So the market is such we could hire fantastic professors without having to pay the highest salaries in the world if one didn't want to. Ken mentioned what's happening with the use of part-time and sessional teachers, and box 14 shows why. The cost for teaching a one-term course for a full-time professor making $100,000 is one quarter times $100,000. And if you add the benefits part of 20%, that comes to $30,000. So it costs $30,000 for the average professor to teach a course. You can hire a sessional instructor with a PhD for about $7,500, i.e. one quarter. Well, how do you think that university administrators balance their books when they are faced with constantly increasing compensation budgets and flatlined overall revenues from tuition and provincial grants? The final box box 14, which just notes how skeptical Canadian institutions and certainly Ontario institutions are of other models. So if you look at the numbers in the California system and you combine the University of California and California State University together, even though California is three times as big as Ontario, the university system is only 1.3 times as big. It's actually quite comparable because in California, of course, there's lots of private universities and other things. So it's not a bad comparison. And it turns out, if you crunch all the numbers, California average faculty salary is 16% lower. The average teaching load is 43% higher. The semester length in California is 15 weeks compared with 12 or 13 weeks in Ontario. You put those numbers together, California students in the public system in California get over twice as many contact hours with full-time faculty as we do in Ontario. And then here's the real kicker for me. what does California spend in its public university system on the faculty time that's devoted to research? It turns out these numbers because there are fewer full-time professors who are on this 2+2 teaching, that California spends 21% less on faculty time for research than Ontario does. And compare the results. The University of California says it's had 27 Nobel Prize winners since 1995. Ontario's last Nobel Prize winner was 1986 with John Pine. California institutions have 5 of their universities in the Times Higher Education Top 50. Ontario has 1. So no one, not even Ontarians, would claim that California is not getting way more research output from its system and yet paying less for the faculty time for research. So that's an extreme example. California is held up historically as a system which was, through public policy from the 60s, was highly differentiated and built that way. It would be impossible, maybe inappropriate, for Canadian provinces to go to that extreme, but it does show the kind of improved value that's possible, both on teaching and research, from better system management and more specialization differentiation. So let me stop there, and the implications of this for me are, because universities are collectively trapped in these phenomena, that it does require government to help universities undertake the necessary reforms. Yeah.
So it falls to me to give you a bit of an argument as to why the university should take the lead in this change, and I think Ian's going to come back afterwards and challenge that a little bit with some of his ideas, but I'm going to elaborate on a couple of things. You know, we have to really question the system that we have as to whether it's actually achieving its goals. And the number I read a while ago was it's 80% of all the scientists who were ever alive in the history of the world are alive today. And that number will be about 90% within 10 years, which is because of the growth of the university system in Asia and South Asia. What that resulting in is a huge explosion in the publications, more journals, more articles. And we know that not only are students reading less, but we actually know that faculty members are reading a lot less. So we're producing more material, we're reading less of it. It's kind of intriguing. My son just took on a teaching job in Ontario, at Ontario University. It's his third year of being a professor, and we sat down last weekend, and he was really perplexed, and he said, to be honest, I enjoy it, but I don't know why I'm doing it. The students don't really seem to be interested in learning, and you assign readings, and they don't do the readings, and they're not bothered by it. They're not bothered by not having done the readings and what have you. And I saw, he gave me this cartoon that he sent along, and it's got this wonderful sort of a joke in the middle of it, where this one guy is saying to a student that as it becomes easier to get a degree, the dumber you look for not having one, which is a huge incentive to do what? I mean, go and get a degree, even if you don't sort of really need one. My sense at Canadian universities, to put a starting point on this, is that at Canadian universities, really all Canadian universities, you have a chance to get an absolutely wonderful education. It's not a guarantee, though. A university degree is supposed to be a guarantee that you have a certain set of skills. And I think right now we're getting a lot of pressure for the reasons that Ian's described. Faculties are supposed to change. Universities are supposed to change. A lot of emphasis on retention efforts and things of that sort. I would suggest to you we're nowhere near demanding enough on students. We don't, you know, when you're talking to students at the beginning of the year, we very rarely stand up and say, this is a 45 to 60 hour a week job. And if you think you can do a university degree without doing less than 45 to 60 hours a week, you're wrong. We don't do that because we're afraid they'll give us a bad review at the end of the day. We also need, some of you, it's on the board up there, but some of you may have read a book called Academically Adrift. It's a really excellent sort of study that basically asks the question, are we actually giving the students the skills we say we're giving? critical thinking, analytical research, and what have you. Their answer, based on a lot of research, is essentially no. That the universities are adding very little transformative value to the students who are there. So my point to pick up where Ian was leaving off is that we have a simple choice. We have to create a culture of change in universities, or as Ian's hinted, the governments will do it for you, and they'll actually also do it to you as institutions. So what do I say to that? Well, number one, be nervous. Be really, really nervous. Governments, if you ask their, listen to public statements by politicians, they say all the right things. They truly love us. They love universities, and they love giving access, and they love our research and what have you. But I think they're saying words that are very different from what we think they're saying. Because what the university means is we want career-ready graduates. We don't want graduates. We want career-ready graduates, people who can move into the workforce, with very tight connections to business. We want the students not to be critics of society, poets or what have you. We want them to be able to get a job in the exact fields where the interest is right now. What does that mean? More applied science, more health, more business, less humanities, less social sciences and fine arts. They love research, particularly if it leads to commercial products, which leads to more businesses, which leads to more jobs, which leads to more wealth, which leads to more taxes, which they might give a little bit back to the universities. They want also lower tuition fees. It would be harder to get the money to pay for this. We have a very inflexible tuition fee regime in Canada. It should be much more flexible. They also want and demand greater accessibility. This is the number one issue for politicians. They want to make sure that all of their constituents' children can go to university, because if the children get turned down, the parents phone and complain about that, and they get in trouble for that particular way. They want us to pay more attention to student success, but they also don't want us to be too demanding of students in the process. They don't want us to fail them out. About a third of all students who start off in university in Canada don't complete. Staggering sort of numbers. And if you actually, depends on how you do the calculations, but if you have 100 students starting off in universities, at the end of the day you probably get about 35 or so who end up in university-related careers. It's not a very high number. And we should be very, very concerned about that. University governments are also not all that interested in curiosity-based research, particularly if the curiosity is about government. There's very little tolerance for university collegial processes. When you go up and say, well, we're trying to get that through the Senate, but you know, there's some really cranky people on the Senate, and they're complaining all the time, and council won't approve it. Government's just like, then make them. Their employees, make them. The understanding of faculty autonomy is not very clear. And they will be very, very concerned about faculty salaries. So essentially what's going on, too, is that over the last number of years, one of the charts on there shows this, is government has paid less and less of the total cost of universities. Tuition's covered more in the last decade or so. And we've gone from what used to be called government-funded universities, because they were the lion's share of the money, to what some people are trying to call government-supported, making the point that governments actually are not all that involved in the financing of it. So isn't it ironic that governments are talking about having more control when they're actually spending less money? We actually have a situation in Canada where several of our universities could go private. If they could walk off the government sort of subsidy thing and sort of start charging full market value, the University of Waterloo could go private. Bishops almost did this. They had a debate about this at Bishops. They came very close to doing it. But Waterloo, if they increase their overall income or overall tuition fee to $12,000 or $14,000 to make up for the lost government income and stuff, they would probably be successful. But we're not going to be allowed to do that because we're government supported or government controlled. So universities don't want to cede control. I think governments, you know, are our friends. But the idea that universities would cede control to the government is a really interesting one. The universities do not want to surrender their autonomy. In a very unhelpful intervention, the Ontario Faculty Unions declared in response to a planning paper in Ontario that they wanted to defend the right of the faculty-controlled senates and councils to make the decisions about whether we went to three-year degrees, whether we offered on a 12-month basis and worked over the summertime, and what have you. Governments don't understand universities all that well. Some individuals do, but not necessarily the whole system, and certainly not the political process. They don't understand the internal dynamics. One aspect of universities that's really hard to explain is how three or four really cranky people can hold up almost any initiative on almost any campus. They get themselves on the right boards, right commissions, the dean reappointment committees, the presidential search committee. They get on a council, or they go on the curriculum advisory committee or something like that, and can slow really good ideas down for a year or two or three, or make it, basically make them disappear. The government doesn't understand that. They also understand this unique character and mandate of universities. Each university is different, has a history and a culture of its own. We do have to make universities less faculty-centric, but we don't want them to lose their connection to their place, their sense of place, and what have you. And I'm also very concerned of the fact that universities, governments, don't often get their decisions right. If you look at the pattern of teacher education, for example, we often expanded in response to a temporary bulge in enrollment, and then we've produced an enormous number of students, graduates. In Ontario right now, in the last year, in 1970, 70%, 1980 I guess it was, 1980, 70% of newly produced teachers got full-time teaching jobs within the 4 months, basically, of graduating. The number this year was 23%. 23% of people with B.Ed. degrees actually got a teaching job, mostly because they wouldn't move out of Toronto, but that's another issue for another day. But 30% of them had nothing, no job whatsoever. It is hardly a success for a university to claim that. We have to tidy that up ourselves. The government decided a number of years ago to expand teaching. Now Ontario is talking about solving the problem by making students go to university for 2 years instead of one to get a teaching certificate. Not a very good solution. And the other problem is that if governments are successful, they'll set a pattern that will be very difficult to break. Once they get going down this line and get their teeth into the ankle of the university system, they won't really let go very quickly. So I asked a post-secondary minister, somebody who'd been a minister a few years back, not from Saskatchewan, what he thought about this kind of issue. Number one thing he said was, if we give you more money, you just give it to faculty salaries, and we don't want to do that anymore. So in fact, they are wanting to take control because we don't think we spend it very well. Second thing he said was that governments should set the vision for the system. Leave the nuts and bolts as to how people fit in, but let's set the vision. So my example for that is in Ontario, a couple of years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, the government decided to double the number of graduate students. Set a big competition among the universities. We want 47, we want 147, we want 347. And they all fought against each other for a portion of this. I remember talking to the minister at the time and saying, well, why don't you tell us where you want the graduate students to be? Because quite frankly, there isn't a huge demand for more PhDs in English. We massively overproduce in English. It's a wonderful degree, but we already produce way too many. And he said, well, we don't want to interfere with university autonomy. So guess what we did? We really have a lot more engineering graduates. That's what they wanted. A lot more graduates in applied health? Not too many. But I'll tell you, we got a lot more English graduates. We have a whole bunch, three-time jump in PhDs in English at the University of Waterloo alone. Huge increase in the number of history majors and political science majors. Not bad things. I think those are wonderful. I'm a historian by training. But the government set the vision and left the details to us, and oops. They just gave us the money, and we competed for it. In Ontario, you got $46,000 in capital money for every student you recruited. And it was an unseemly mess of watching us, you're only 72%, but you're in. Because we need that $46,000. Next year, we don't need you. We'll fail you out. But we need that $46,000 right now. And so we went after it very, very aggressively. Most ominously, the thing he said also was he said, we got visited a lot by university presidents. And the university president said, it really helps if you guide us. It really helps if you tell us what we should do. And then we'll respond internally. But it really helps if we have an external person telling us what to do. But what does it say when you assemble among the smartest group of people anywhere in the country, pick any university at random, all these people with PhDs and master's degrees and years of experience, they're fabulous researchers, they understand how the world operates, you turn them together and say, we're not going to expect you to solve your own problems. That's crazy. It's just really crazy. But here's the other thing that happened. We were visited in one province I was in before by a member of the opposition party, which was about 2 or 3 months away from being elected. And the leader of the opposition party came to the university and said, I'm really here to help. I love universities. Universities are absolutely great. And we know you want to change. And our president at the time said, yes, yes, we really want to change. We're in touch with the times and all that kind of stuff. He said, well, here's what we're going to do for you. We're going to hold back 15% of your budget. And we're going to give it to you if you do new things. So that way, you can take this hold back, get rid of all the things you don't want to do anymore, because you all know what they are. That Department of Antarctic Studies that you don't want anymore, you can get rid of it, close it down, and then come over here with the Department of Dance, and we'll add the Department of Dance. And I thought the president was going to faint. They're like, please don't do this. 15% cut at a university anywhere in Canada would be absolutely catastrophic. And you wouldn't end up closing the programs down because of faculty contracts and collective agreements and all this kind of stuff. So it's not going to be easy. There are tons of reasons why this is going to be hard. Which university in Canada will voluntarily switch from being a research-intensive university to being a teaching-intensive institution? Which one will do exactly what Ian has targeted said there? Nope, everybody says, well, we have a regional mandate. No, we're the one for southwestern Ontario. We're the one for northern British Columbia. We can't stop doing research. They're not talking about this kind of thing. A lot of universities are going this way by default for financial reasons. McMaster, whatever research-intensive university, has a university teaching professor program now. They hire people who are just teachers, and it's wonderful. UBC has it as well. Lots of places have it. But imagine a whole university president coming in and saying, okay, University of Northern Ontario, there isn't one, you are now going to be a teaching-intensive institution. We're going to scale back. We're going to change the teaching arrangements, all that kind of stuff. That president would have the shortest lifespan of any university president in history. We know the barriers. We are very slow changing. Universities are incredibly, incredibly slow to change. Our decision-making processes are way too unresponsive. They're controlled by opponents. Many universities think we can wait out governments. If you don't like this minister, wait a couple of months, you'll get a new one. You know, the deputy minister, complain a little bit, maybe you'll get a new deputy minister. And the government will change in time. As long as we can hold on until that next election, everything will work out as well. Also, last barrier, universities have given away most of the tools they need for effective management. You cannot replace faculty members fast enough. We make General Motors look like a high-tech startup company. You cannot move people out of the professoriate fast enough. So if you've got a department over here in Antarctic Studies that has one student in it, it's really, really hard to shut that department down and to go over to this other area where there's a huge demand. It's extremely difficult. To use my own faculty at University of Waterloo when I was there as an example, we had 14 faculty members studying Germany, and we had 2 faculty members doing research on Asia. And if you think that's a model for 21st century Canada, it's absurd. But we'd hired them in good faith and good judgment back, 25, 30 years ago. And when the department, when people came to retire, 30 years on, did they come and say, time for us to hire a Chinese historian or a Chinese political science? No. They had courses on the books in German politics, so they wanted to hire in German politics. But what we can do, there are lots of things to do. Universities can make this a really exciting dynamic process. We can look at differentiation, as Ian's already suggested, in a major way. We can mobilize the research and analytical talent on a campus. It's a marvelous sort of idea. Actually, get the researchers there to start looking at themselves, the system, the local economy, local society, and what have you. We don't do very good in that. We actually come up with our innovative academic plans for universities look pretty much alike, small variations. We don't get very many calls for oceanography in Saskatchewan, so we have a little bit different program than Memorial or Dalhousie. They're not so good on prairie agriculture either. But beyond that, we actually are all looking at teaching, research, graduate studies, outreach, and internationalization. But we can actually tackle this ourselves. We can make it a high-end, campus-wide, interdisciplinary, exciting kinds of things. We must, in the process of doing this, engage constantly with government. They're not opponents. They're not enemies. The governments are wonderful people with way too few resources, way too few staff people, working on very, very difficult things. But we can show them that we are trying to change and get their input into that change. But the most important thing I would say is a university has to decide up front if it's going to make difficult decisions, if it's actually going to close down faculties, down departments, close down programs, release faculty members in areas where there's not sufficient demand, whether we're going to stay with the status quo or whether we're going to make the kind of changes that would be responsive in this kind of direction. If we're not, then what we're going to do is listen really carefully to what Ian says right now about what we're going to do instead.
Again, it's a bit hard to have a debate with someone when you agree with 99% of what he says. But I would, I guess the one point that I'd like to emphasize here just in closing, and I guess this is my biggest word, is that if neither government nor universities take these trends sufficiently seriously to say, we do have to change something, then what will happen? These curves will just continue. Faculty salaries will keep rising faster than Canadians' median income. Faculty will continue to teach less and less. And the student-faculty ratios will get worse and worse. And the overall educational experience of Canadians at the undergraduate level will get worse and worse. And that is a pretty awful outcome from the perspective of all of those of us, as Ken says, who love universities and feel so passionately about what their mission is. Let me close on that point, Ken, and open it for questions.